The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 15th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. As usual, we start with the main stories and how they were covered. A bad election day for the Tea Party. What happened? Political moderation was the big winner in off-year elections this week, as Democrat Terry McAuliffe narrowly defeated a Tea Party conservative to become governor of Virginia, and New Jersey's moderate Republican governor, Chris Christie, was reelected in a landslide. McAuliffe beat Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia by just 3 points, in a race that was widely seen as a national bellwether. Cuccinelli ran a deeply conservative campaign, condemning immigration reform and Obamacare, and pledging to restrict access to abortions. McAuliffe, a former business executive and ally of Bill and Hillary Clinton, outspent Cuccinelli by as much as 10-1 and positioned himself as a business-friendly pragmatist who could work with Republicans. Cuccinelli credited his comeback from double-digit deficits in the polls to a voter backlash against President Obama. Despite being outspent by an unprecedented $15 million, this race came down to the wire because of Obamacare, he said. In an Alabama congressional primary, Senator Bradley Byrne, the choice of establishment Republicans, defeated Tea Party challenger Dean Young. Christie's huge 22-point victory in New Jersey installed him as the Republican to beat in the 2016 presidential primaries. Across the Hudson River, Bill de Blasio was elected the first Democratic mayor of New York City in 20 years, defeating Republican candidate Joe Lotta with a defiantly progressive platform. De Blasio built his campaign on A Tale of Two Cities, saying he wanted to narrow the gap between the city's wealthy elites and the 46% of New Yorkers near or below the poverty line. What the editorials said. These results hold important lessons for the GOP, said USA Today. The party might easily have won in Virginia without an outspoken extremist like Cuccinelli on the ballot. This longtime culture warrior alienated female and moderate voters with hardline policies such as personhood laws that would have banned abortion and some kinds of contraception, and a push to restore the state's ban on sodomy. The message to Republicans who wish to become a majority party again is clear. Stop nominating candidates who are far out of the political mainstream. Christie may be the new hero of mainstream Republican conservatives, said the Washington Post. But Bill de Blasio has become the standard bearer for the Democratic left, embodying the liberal anger at President Obama's failure to address income inequality and stand up for the 99%. De Blasio's challenge now goes from electioneering to governing, said the New York Post. And there's little to be optimistic about. Progressive mayors overspent and overtaxed the city into an economic morass in the 1970s and 80s and let criminals run amok. De Blasio will erase 20 years of progress if he follows that same course. What the columnist said, Democrats have little reason to celebrate, said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Yes, the government shutdown engineered by the Tea Party put Cuccinelli in a deep hole. But even in purple Virginia, growing voter anger over the various betrayals in Obamacare wound up turning a rout into a narrow election. Cuccinelli lost for a simple reason, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. As an activist attorney general, he tried to impose on all Virginians a social and religious code that was extreme, hateful, and intrusive. He opposed abortion even for rape and incest victims, advocated transvaginal ultrasounds to intimidate women seeking abortions, and insisted on abstinence-only sex education. Female voters swung for McAuliffe by 14 points, sending a message to all would-be conservative lawmakers that attempts to control women will be met with a no. Just do the math, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. In a country in which just 35% of voters identify as conservatives, a center-right candidate is going to do a lot better than a far-right candidate. Still, it's an ominous sign for Democrats that McAuliffe barely won, said Nate Cohn in NewRepublic.com. He was running under all but ideal conditions, with a vast money advantage in a state where many federal government workers are still fuming over the Republican shutdown. If Democrats struggle to beat a seriously flawed candidate like Cuccinelli, Republicans should be feeling relatively confident heading into 2014. Drone takes out a Taliban leader. The CIA's drone program claimed one of its highest-profile scalps last week when the leader of the Pakistani Taliban, Hakamullah Massoud, was killed by a missile strike in the country's lawless northwest tribal area. Vowing to avenge their leader's death, the Taliban said, "Every drop of Hakamullah's blood will turn into a suicide bomber." The CIA had been hunting the Islamist extremist since 2009, when he orchestrated a suicide bombing in Afghanistan that killed seven of the agency's employees. Although the Pakistani Taliban and their allies are estimated to have killed more than 17,800 civilians and almost 5,500 security personnel in Pakistan since 2003, the country's government condemned the drone strike as sabotage, saying the U.S. wanted to murder forthcoming peace talks with the militant group. A major threat to the U.S. has been eliminated, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Massoud was the brains behind the failed 2010 plot to detonate a car bomb in New York City's Times Square, which could have killed and maimed hundreds. Pakistan may protest that we violated its security, but so long as it allows terrorist enclaves on its soil, the U.S. has every right under the rules of war to use drones to protest to protect Americans. Massoud was a cruel and effective terrorist leader, said Samira Shackle in TheGuardian.com, but his death will make little difference to the militants' bloody campaign. Massoud took over the group in 2009 when his predecessor was killed in a drone strike. And already the Taliban is moving to appoint a new boss. Which raises the question, what hope is there for peace? Not much, said Paul Sinkman at USNews.com. A negotiated settlement is unlikely, since the Taliban are demanding the implementation of brutal Sharia across the nation. Pakistan's government, which privately supports drone strikes, won't launch a ground offensive to root out the Taliban from their mountainous hideout, out of fear of killing huge numbers of civilians. For combating these fanatical jihadists, U.S. drones are still the only tool in the toolbox. At the bottom of the main stories page is a small section called "It Wasn't All Bad." And I'd like to read you one blurb from that. A girl with a condition that causes baldness has overcome the trauma of losing her hair at age 12 and won a beauty pageant. Angelica Galindez, 19, applied for the Miss Philippines Earth pageant with a picture of herself in a wig, but got the organizers' approval to compete without it and embrace her natural look. The teenager, who has alopecia areata, won one of six crowns and will now travel to the Philippines for the contest next round. If you have confidence, and the judges see that, then that's more beautiful than anything else, she said. The controversy of the week. Christie. Why he's already the GOP's 2016 frontrunner. After this week's election, Republican insiders agree on one thing, said Chris Siliza in WashingtonPost.com. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is the GOP's best and maybe only hope to win back the White House in 2016. With the rest of the party roiled by ideological infighting and suffering from new lows in popularity in national opinion polls, the combative, charismatic Christie cruised to re-election in a blue northeastern state, winning 60% of the vote. No other candidate for the GOP nomination can boast Christie's level of cross-party appeal, least of all the Tea Party-backed Senators Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, his most likely rivals. The exit poll results make an emphatic case for a Christie presidential bid, said John Avlon in the DailyBeast.com. Though his record is distinctly conservative, he won Hispanics by 6%, independents by an eye-popping 31%, and women by 15%, against a female challenger. If Christie can do half as well nationally, he could extricate the GOP from its demographic trap and put a Republican back in the White House. Hold off for the coronation for now, said Reed Wilson in WashingtonPost.com. The Republican establishment may love Christie, but the conservative base dominates the primaries. To hard-right Tea Party supporters, Christie is suspiciously moderate. This is a governor, after all, who signed a law banning gay conversion therapy, signed 10 gun control bills into law, dropped his appeal of a court ruling legalizing gay marriage, supported free tuition for illegal immigrants, and, most unforgivably of all, publicly praised and hugged President Obama for his response to Hurricane Sandy just days before the 2012 election. Christie's bullying, Tony Soprano-like personality won't stand up to the pressure of a national race, said Peter Keating in NYMag.com, and neither will his record. Despite cutting corporate taxes by $600 million a year and giving businesses $2 billion in tax credits, Christie has failed to revive New Jersey's economy, with the state ranking 44th in the nation in job creation. He's played games with the state's budget, too, deferring pension obligations until he's out of office, and cutting aid to schools and municipalities. Newark Star-Ledger columnist Tom Moran calls Christie America's most overrated governor. In the end, though, what will matter to Republicans is that Christie shares their indignant rage, said Joel Mathis in PhillyMag.com. In the final days of his gubernatorial campaign, when any prudent politician would have been playing it safe, Christie got in a shouting match with a middle school teacher who was protesting his education cuts. Jabbing his finger in her face, he bellowed, "I'm tired of you people." To conservatives in the age of Obama, that refusal to take any guff is a badge of authenticity, proof that Christie, like them, seethes with good old-fashioned resentment of pointy-headed liberals who think they're smarter or better or more compassionate than you. It's worked in Democrat-heavy New Jersey, so why not in the rest of the nation? Asked David Hersanyi in TheFederalist.com. Christie struggles with his weight, his explosions of temper, and his willingness to shout "shut up" at reporters, union members, and critics have actually endeared him to his constituents, even if they don't always agree with him. He seems real, with no patience for the niceties of modern politics. Given the current level of public disgust with politicians, Chris Christie might not be what conservatives want, but he may be what they need. It was a good week for midnight snackers after a British inventor used fluorescent proteins from jellyfish to create an ice cream that glows in the dark. Charlie Francis said he thought his invention was safe, since "I tried some, and I don't seem to be glowing anywhere." It was a good week for imaginative defenses after a Canadian man tried to evade punishment under Dubai's strict anti-profanity law by claiming that in Canada, the phrase "F off" is a colorful way of telling another person to walk away. It was a good week for evading Big Brother after China's government admitted that its ubiquitous security cameras cannot see through the dense pollution shrouding the nation's cities. "On the smoggiest days, we may need to use a radar," said one scientist. It was a bad week for sex education after an Oregon middle school football coach outraged parents by holding a team party at a Hooters restaurant, which features busty waitresses. "I believe this is a fine venue," Randy Burbach said. "If you have a dirty mind, you'll find dirt." It was a bad week for gang signs after the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club sued Dillard's department store for selling hats and shirts emblazoned with a logo similar to the biker's winged death head. "Guys live and die for that patch," said Hells Angel attorney Fritz Clapp. And it was a bad week for Saudi Arabia's space program after cleric Sheikh Ali al-Himki issued a fatwa against volunteering for the Mars One manned expedition, saying that taking a one-way ride to Mars would be suicidal and did not conform to responsible Muslim practices. On the briefing page this week, we have the Face Mask Nation. Air pollution has made many cities in China barely suitable for living and is making the population sick and angry. How bad is China's smog? 16 of the world's 20 most polluted cities are in China. The air in some cities is so bad that at times visibility drops to 30 feet. Traffic slows to a crawl, and nearly everyone wears masks over their noses and mouths. In Harbin, a city of 11 million people, government officials recently shut down roads, schools, and the airport when air pollution levels hit 40 times the safe limit set by the World Health Organization. During the airpocalypse in Beijing earlier this year, the density of small, lung-penetrating particles reached 993 micrograms per cubic meter, a concentration normally not seen outside of forest fires. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency considers anything above 300 dangerous and maxes out its scale at 500. The smog was so thick in Beijing, which English-speaking residents call Greijing, that a factory building burned for 3 hours before anyone even noticed that it was in flames. Why is China's air so polluted? It's the result of 2 decades of runaway economic development, unrestrained by strong air pollution laws, a dramatic increase in car ownership, and China's overwhelming reliance on coal. China's cities were filled with bicycles as recently as the 1990s, But thanks to the explosive growth of the middle class, the Chinese now own more than 120 million cars and another 120 million motor vehicles of other kinds. Fuel standards set by a government committee stacked with oil industry members have not kept pace. Auto emissions, however, account for only about 25% of the problem. Most of the blame rests on coal. China burns almost as much coal as the rest of the world combined. Despite making large investments in renewable energy, China still depends on coal to meet nearly 70% of its power needs. While air pollution is almost always bad in northern China, it really soars after cities turn on their coal-fired collective heating systems for the winter heating season. Temperature inversions often trap bad air for days or weeks. What are the health effects? They're widespread and severe. In 2010, air pollution contributed to 1.2 million premature deaths in China, according to a study. Hospitals in Harbin reported a 30% increase in patients with respiratory problems after air pollution spiked in the city. Lung cancer rates in China have climbed by 465% over the last three decades, despite there being no significant increase in smoking rates. Scientists say the pollution in northern cities is so severe that 500 million people's lives will be shortened by an average of 5.5 years. How else is smog hurting China? It's damaging the country's economy. In 2012, smog-related economic losses in four major Chinese cities totaled $1.08 billion, according to a study by Greenpeace and Peking's University School of Public Health. Largely in response to the airpocalypse, tourism in Beijing has dropped by 50% this year, the Beijing Youth Daily reported last week. The pollution has also hurt efforts by Beijing-based businesses to recruit top foreign talent. More potential employees are demanding hardship pay for having to deal with the city's awful air quality. With studies connecting prenatal exposure to air pollutants with autism, depression, and long-term lung damage, many foreign and local parents are second-guessing their living in Beijing, said family physician Richard St. Cyr, who is based there. Are Chinese citizens angry? Yes, and they are increasingly willing to show it. Chinese netizens this year defied a government ban and began sharing hourly air quality measurements from the U.S. Embassy in downtown Beijing. Microblogging sites like Sina Weibo have served as forums for citizens to express their frustrations with China's air quality. Our requirements aren't high, posted radio reporter Guo Yasu. We just want clean food, clean water, and clean air. The dissatisfaction has given rise to a growing environmental movement, with 30,000 to 50,000 mass incidents of protests every year, according to former Communist Party official Chen Jiping. Is the Chinese government listening? The grumbling has become too loud to ignore. This year, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang claimed that the country's smog made him quite upset, while the state-run China Daily bluntly referred to major cities like Beijing as barely suitable for living. That is a big change from 2011, when the state media referred to China's choking air pollution with the euphemism heavy fog. Now China says it will spend $817 billion on a plan to drastically cut pollution by 2017. While that might sound like real progress, provincial officials and state-owned businesses in China have a history of ignoring policies handed down from the central government. Critics also note that the new air pollution plan calls for only a 2% reduction in coal consumption, the result of the Chinese coal industry's powerful influence. Tong Tzu, an air pollution specialist who travels between Princeton University and Beijing, sees political infighting in China's giant bureaucracy as the biggest impediment to progress. There is technology available to fix the problem, he told NPR. I think as long as there is political willingness, the environmental situation can be drastically improved. We'll take a look now at the best columns from the U.S. Why We Spy on Everyone, from L. Gordon Krowitz at the Wall Street Journal. No one should be shocked that the National Security Agency eavesdropped on German Chancellor Angela Merkel's phone calls, said L. Gordon Krowitz. Intelligence agencies snoop on both hostile and friendly nations and leaders, and history suggests there are real costs when they don't. The last time the U.S. curtailed its intelligence operations, it proved a disaster. In 1929, Henry Stimson, President Hoover's Secretary of State, shut down the government's cipher bureau, which had broken the codes of a dozen countries in order to snoop on diplomatic messages. Gentlemen, Stimson explained, do not read other gentlemen's mail. As Germany and Japan built their war machines over the next decade, the U.S. was operating blind, thanks to Stimson's delicate sensibilities. Pearl Harbor changed Stimson's mind about spying, and his War Department developed new technology that broke the Japanese and German codes and helped win the war. Today, all nations spy on each other. The U.S. is just better at it, which is a good thing. To avoid nasty surprises, gentlemen do read other gentlemen's mail. The best way to execute murderers. Let's bring back the guillotine, said John Kruzel. That idea may sound crazy, but head chopping is probably the most humane option available now that states with the death penalty can't get the drugs they use for lethal injections. There is much disturbing evidence that the previous cocktail paralyzed inmates being executed without rendering them unconscious, so they sometimes suffocated to death in excruciating pain. New, untested cocktails being rushed into service by the states might even be more barbaric. Personally, I find all executions to be immoral, but as long as some states are killing prisoners, they might as well go with a tried-and-true method. Severing the head is believed to be one of the quickest, least painful ways to die. Victims' families who witness executions for a sense of closure may also find death by guillotine more satisfying than a lethal injection. Would a return to an 18th-century execution technique horrify some people, including death penalty supporters? No doubt. But if governments are going to kill people in the name of justice, maybe it makes sense to be confronted by how gruesome it really is. And finally, the smug confidence of libertarians, from Nora Kaplan Bricker at NewRepublic.com. Why are most libertarians white dudes? Asked Nora Kaplan Bricker. Of the 7% of Americans who identify as libertarian, a new survey finds 94% of them are non-Hispanic whites, and more than two-thirds are men. Don't women and minorities want to be free to forge their own destinies too? Apparently, the kind of absolute freedom that libertarianism promises is more appealing to white men, who for good historical reasons find it easier to imagine themselves as winner in a Hobbesian struggle for survival and rewards. Women, blacks, Hispanics, and other minorities find it easier to imagine the possibility of losing. And they know that once you fall without a safety net, the lows are bottomless. One study found that half the women earning $25,000 or more and 27% of those earning $200,000 or more believe they could wind up homeless if they suffer a few bad breaks. In a capitalistic, competitive society, we can't all be winners. That's why rational people agreed to a social contract that protects the losers from abject poverty, starvation, and death. But to people smugly confident of winning, no net is necessary. The last word article this week, the secret world of cargo ships. On a modern shipping vessel, said Rose George, what's in the hold is unknown, even to the people moving it. The bridge of a modern ship is a shock on first encounter. Although this place is still known as the wheelhouse, the wheel at the helm is not wooden and impressive, but mundane plastic, the kind that would suit a video arcade game. Nearly all else is automated. A bank of screens contains radar, ECDIS, an electronic chart system, and AIS, an automatic identification system that transmits the ship's name, speed, and heading, and other details to other ships, port authorities, and well-equipped pirates. There is radio, a gyro compass, and magnetic compass, a tachometer, and echo sounder. Captain Glenn Wolstenholm is often to be found on the bridge. He is here for port approaches and departures, but also whenever he can escape paperwork, which is not as often as he would like. Now that the role of ship's purser has ceased to exist, and all the administration falls on the captain and senior officers. He can be on his computer for 4 to 8 hours a day now. Glenn is the most senior captain in Maersk's container fleet. In older times, he would have been known as Commodore and saluted by the raising of flags on courteous passing ships. His talk turns often to earlier times because he has done enough years to have plenty, and because in his 4 decades on ships, life at sea has changed dramatically. His first ship was a tramp steamer, a freelance vessel that picks up trade where it can, not a liner with a scheduled route like Kendall, his current ship, a taxi, not a bus. It was iron, had derrick cranes on deck to heft cargo about, and was held together by rivets. Rivets! Not like this Korean-made welded ship, only 4 years old. In front of him, the captain sees sea, but mostly he sees boxes. Orange, blue, gray, red. If the captain leaves the wheelhouse to stand on the port or starboard wings, the bridge's 2 terraces, he will see boxes fore and aft. That is, if he sees them at all. For him, they are blank, boring. I'm indifferent to them. They're just boxes, you have to admit. He thinks they have destroyed the soul of a ship and the shipping. This is an old lament. In the middle of the shift from the sail to steam, Joseph Conrad complained that the loading of ships was once a matter of skill, judgment, and knowledge. With the modern steamship, cargo was dumped in through her 6 hatchways with clatter and hurry and racket and heat, in a cloud of steam and a mess of coal dust. Sometime toward the end of the 1960s, when the captain was a young cadet, he saw his first boxes. They were being carried by an American ship that was departing Hong Kong as he was arriving. I was out on the poop deck, and some of the crew said, "Look, that's a container. That's a thing of the future." He didn't pay much attention because cadets didn't pay much attention to things like creation of globalization. We were too busy blinking, learning stuff. But he had listened to the crew, who kept talking about these strange metal things. They said, "That'll never take off." They said, "How are they going to get a truck in that? How will they get steel and timber into it?" But it did take off. There are at least 20 million containers crossing the world now. Quiet blank boxes, thanks to a U.S. businessman named Malcolm McLean, who thought people who moved freight would find it easier if they could shift everything in a box, rather than the confusion of general cargo, of barrels and boxes and piles, of each company having its own system. McLean's spark was to call on an engineer, Keith Tatlinger, to create a design that could be seamlessly stacked and locked in place, using twist locks. This new box could fit trains, trucks, cranes, and ships alike. The intermodality made perfect commercial sense, and labor unions hated it. Dockers in particular were furious. McLean claimed his box system reduced labor by two-thirds, cutting dockers' workload, salary, and power. For a while, they held up the march of the box, as did geography and physics. Ships that carried many boxes would have to be bigger, with deeper drafts. New ports had to be built. New York's maritime wharves, too shallow, too narrow, became useless. And the massive greater port of New York, New Jersey was constructed instead. But the rewards of containerization were too great for dockers to defeat change. Before containers, transport costs ate up to 25% of the value of whatever was being shipped. With the extreme efficiencies that intermodality brought, costs were reduced to a pittance. A sweater can now travel 3,000 miles for 2.5 cents. It cost 1 cent to send a can of beer. Shipping a container can cost next to nothing, an invaluable advantage in hard economic times, when there is more supply than demand. In his junior officer days, the captain was in favor of boxes. They looked like a simpler life. No more general cargo, all the work involved, no more gear, cranes, derricks, nothing. I thought, this has got to be easier. His first cellular container ship, one specially built for boxes rather than having to fit them in among derricks and holds, carried only 10 containers. Then there were more and more, and he learned that the boxes gave the gift of speed, but they also sucked away his time. You couldn't get any sleep when port hours were so rushed and hurried. Before boxes, he wondered if he had time to go ashore for dinner. Now he wonders if he has time to get a newspaper. He doesn't wonder about the contents of the boxes. They are things full of things to be moved according to schedule. He doesn't know what's inside them, and he doesn't care. I know he drives a Harley Davidson at home, so I needle him. What if there were a box full of Harleys? Then there's one full of Harleys. I'm used to the fact that there's no way to get to see them anyway. It would take him days to read the full manifest of all the cargo on Kindle. And anyway, there isn't one on board. A modern container ship is crewed by people who have no idea what they're carrying. Kendall's crews know only the contents of the refrigerated boxes and the flammable or toxic goods, so that they can put out fires if necessary. We are carrying paint, lacquer, enamel, stain, shellac solutions, varnish, and polish. Somewhere there is liquid flavoring, which is highly flammable and may cause vapors that explode if they meet air. Elsewhere there is some tetramethyl naphthalene ethanone, a chemical that can be used for in air fresheners or to reduce odor in permed hair. there are 1,828 kilograms of carbamate pesticide, a substance highly toxic to humans, and 180,000 kilograms of metal powder, self-heating. This, I read, may react violently with water. On a ship at sea, in containers that are weatherproof, not waterproof. In 2004, Al-Qaeda reportedly recruited a maritime expert. U.S. security sources revealed in 2010 that the organization had been working out how to best blow up oil tankers. Though why bother with intercontinental missiles or explosives? The urban planning academic Stephen Cohen writes, when you can just ship everything you need in parts and assemble it at the required destination. Containers are the poor man's missiles. You no longer have to be a big, powerful government to create catastrophe. In 2003, ABC News shipped depleted uranium from Jakarta to Los Angeles in an attempt to expose the weaknesses in port barriers. The stunt didn't go down well at the Department of Homeland Security, whose declared mission is to stop dangerous things and dangerous people from entering the country. Even if those dangerous things are sent by people from a national news channel. In fact, shipping uranium is legal, as long as you declare it. ABC didn't, and no one checked. Connecting the sea to terrorism has become popular in security studies. Al-Qaeda certainly understands ships, not only because it rammed the USS Cole with a boat, but because it is thought to own or charter a small fleet. North Korea has its own flag, a fleet of 242 vessels, and the ability to make maritime mischief. Lloyd's List reported in 2012 that 120 vessels had reported GPS malfunctions in seas near North Korea. In an article that suspected the work of a North Korean signals jammer. A senior government official was asked in 2002 about the threat of maritime terrorism. This industry is a shadowy underworld, he said. After 9/11, we suddenly realized how little we understood about commercial shipping. In 2010, Nigerian security forces discovered 240 tons of rockets, mortar shells, and small arms ammunition in 13 containers that had been shipped on the German-owned, French-operated, Marshall Islands-flagged Everest from Bandar Abbas in Iran, despite UN sanctions that prohibit Iran from selling arms. The contraband was hidden behind marble slabs and fiberglass. The manifest showed that the recipient was to order. In short, according to a report, the ship's owners, operators, and officers had no knowledge or reason for suspicion regarding the container. Under the layered security scheme managed by the Customs and Border Protection Agency, the perfect U.S.-bound container behaves like this. First, the foreign factory that packs it will have joined the Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism and been vetted. Importers and carriers provide information to U.S. Customs, which uses an automated tracking system to identify high-risk containers. The box is shipped to a foreign port that has signed up to the Container Security Initiative, where foreign officials working harmoniously with U.S. Customs identify and scan containers using non-intrusive inspection equipment and radiation portal monitors. In the words of the Government Accountability Office, while the box is sailing safely onward, updates on its progress are electronically transmitted to the United States. If further doubt remains about the level of risk it poses, upon arrival, the container is screened with more non-intrusive inspection equipment and detained or set free. It is a beautiful vision of a safer global supply chain, a system to scan 100% of all U.S.-bound cargo was to be in place by July 2012. Six foreign ports signed on to the 100% requirement, but by February 2012, five had dropped out. The process was too expensive and too difficult. In reality, scanning every single U.S.-bound container is an outlandish idea. Customs officials attempting to scan all U.S.-bound containers leaving one Hong Kong terminal managed only 5%. The authors of a study commissioned by the EU thought the 100% target akin to a trade barrier and undiplomatically said so. The technology to do the scanning isn't yet good enough. The blockages would choke ports. Trade is movement. Trade is sacred. In 2012, the Department of Homeland Security quietly pushed the 100% deadline to 2014 and counting. This article was excerpted from 90% of everything inside shipping, the invisible industry that puts clothes on your back, gas in your car, and food on your plate, by Rose George, published in August of 2013. On the Health and Science page, how snakes gave humans good vision. Did primates develop superior vision so our ancestors could dodge dangerous snakes? That's the implication of a new study that found that visual cells in monkeys' brains are hardwired by evolution to react more sharply to images of snakes than to other stimuli. Researchers inserted electrodes into the brains of two macaque monkeys, aiming for the pulvinar, a cluster of neurons that is thought to control reflexive head and eye movement. Though the monkeys had never encountered snakes, their pulvinar neurons fired more rapidly and more often when the animals were shown images of coiled and elongated snakes than they did at the sight of geometric shapes or the faces and hands of monkeys. Evolutionary biologist Lynn Isbell of the University of California, Davis, says this suggests that the extraordinary visual acuity of some primates, including early Homo sapiens, developed primarily to keep them from being eaten. They were actually prey, Isbell tells the Los Angeles Times. Snakes lie in wait. They don't move very much, so it's crucial to see them before they see us and to avoid them. Primates that evolved in environments without poisonous snakes, such as the lemurs of Madagascar, have the poorest eyesight in the primate world. Women's gift for multitasking. Busy women who juggle home and career often claim to be better at multitasking than men. And now there's evidence to support them. After administering several tests to 120 men and 120 women, British psychologists concluded that men have more trouble juggling priorities and are slower and less organized than women when switching between them. The researchers found that men and women were equally adept at completing two tasks on a computer when they could tackle them one at a time. But men's performance slowed more substantially, by 77% compared with 69% for women, when they were forced to switch rapidly between the tasks. In another experiment, participants were given 8 minutes to locate restaurants on a map, do simple math problems, answer the phone, and decide how to search for a lost key in a field. Particularly in the lost key challenge, women outperformed men, who were more impulsive and failed to think through their search. University of Hertfordshire psychologist Keith Laws tells BBC.com that the study suggests that, in a stressed and complex situation, women are more able to stop and think about what's going on in front of them. The health scare of the week, robust kids dying from the flu. A child's general good health is no guarantee that a case of flu won't have fatal consequences, according to a new study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A surprising 43% of the 830 children who died from flu complications in the U.S. between October 2004 and September 2012 were otherwise healthy and did not have high-risk medical conditions such as asthma, diabetes, cancer, congenital heart defects, or neurological disorders. The most sobering message is that almost half of these children had no underlying medical condition. They were normal, healthy children. Vanderbilt University medical professor William Schaffner tells USA Today, "That's a profound fact when you think about it." The findings emerge from the first comprehensive analysis of childhood flu deaths since a national surveillance system began tracking such cases nearly a decade ago. Researchers also found that children in good health seemed to progress from the initial flu infection to death more rapidly than children with high-risk medical conditions. The CDC recommends that all children 6 months or older get the flu vaccine every year. On the Talking Points page, Obamacare, the winners and the losers. Jennifer Harris is one of Obamacare's many losers, said Chan Terhune in the Los Angeles Times. The self-employed lawyer recently received a letter from her insurer saying her $98 a month individual health plan was being canceled since it didn't meet the requirements of President Obama's Affordable Care Act. The California resident and her husband earn too much to qualify for subsidized health insurance under the new federal law. Their joint income is $80,000. And the cheapest policy she's found so far runs to $238 a month. It doesn't seem right to make the middle class pay so much more in order to give health insurance to everybody else, Harris said. Obama knew his law would result in a cancellation epidemic, said DeRoy Murdoch in NationalReview.com. Back in 2010, his administration estimated that two-thirds of those in the individual insurance market, up to 15 million people, could lose their policies thanks to Obamacare. Yet Obama straight out lied to the nation, repeatedly promising, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. Obama deserves some of the heat for that misstatement, said Frama Harrop in Providence, Rhode Island Journal. But most of the plans now being canceled are pure junk. The losers are furious only because they haven't had a medical crisis yet, so they don't realize that they were paying for imaginary coverage. Take the $65 a month policy that Judith Gross, 48, signed up for. When the Michigan saleswoman developed breast cancer, she was faced with a $30,000 medical bill. But her plan would pay out only $1,000 a year for outpatient treatment and $2,000 for hospitalization. Unable to come up with $27,000, she put off treatment until her tumor had tripled in size. Under Obamacare, policies cannot require consumers to spend more than $6,000 a year on health costs. The law produces way more winners than losers, says Ryan Lizza in NewYorker.com. The 14% of Americans currently without insurance will win by getting access to affordable health policies. The 80% of people who get their insurance through their employer, Medicare or Medicaid, will see no change. That leaves 6% who buy their own plans on the individual market. Just half of that group, 9 million people, will face higher premiums because their incomes make them ineligible for subsidies, said Jonathan Gruber, an MIT economist who helped develop the law. That's a shame, said Gruber. But no law in the history of America makes everyone better off. We've just begun to realize how many losers Obamacare creates, said Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com. In 2018, a lot of folks with employer-sponsored insurance are also going to see their insurance changed. That's when a 40% Cadillac tax will be levied on high-cost plans that provide workers, mostly union members and those in high-paying jobs, with extremely generous benefits. Millions of workers will be switched to plans with higher deductibles and copays are going to be screaming mad. Such complaints are breathtakingly cynical, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. Any plan to reform our broken health care system involves trade-offs, and Republican proposals would involve far larger disruptions. The 2012 budget approved by the GOP-controlled House, for instance, would have kicked up to 20 million people off Medicaid. Do they count as losers? Every conservative health care proposal also calls for drastically curtailing the tax deduction for employer-based insurance, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The right's ideal is to get rid of company-provided insurance altogether and have us all go shopping on the individual market. Right now, these hypocrites are silent about their alternatives while trying to whip up fear of change. Going back to the status quo isn't a viable option, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Want to talk about losers? Consider the case of Richard Streeter, a 47-year-old truck driver from Oregon. He tried to buy health insurance after his employer dropped coverage in 2008, but as a lifelong smoker in his late 40s, he couldn't find an affordable plan. So he took a terrible chance and did without. In September, Streeter was diagnosed with advanced colon cancer, and it may be too late to save him. The biggest health care crisis is not that a few million Americans will pay more for better health care under Obamacare. It's that 50 million people like Richard Streeter have virtually no health care at all. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time.